of Block against Frischholz. Mr. Feinerman.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Gary Feinerman from Sidley Austin, here on behalf of Lynn, Helen, and Nathan Block. Unless the Court directs me elsewhere, I'll touch upon the two issues raised in our en banc petition. The first is whether the Fair Housing Act allows owners and tenants to bring discrimination claims absent a constructive eviction, and the second is whether the defendant's actions here as a matter of law were not discriminatory. With respect to the first issue, in 1988, Congress gave the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development the authority to enforce the Fair Housing Act and to promulgate regulations. And the next year, HUD, pursuant to formal notice and comment rulemaking, promulgated regulations providing that Sections 3604B and 3617 of the Fair Housing Act prohibits discrimination against owners and tenants on account of race, ethnicity, and gender. Those regulations are 100.65B2, discriminatory failure or delay of maintenance of repair or dwellings, which obviously applies post acquisition, 100.65B4, which expressly references owners and tenants being discriminated against, and 100.400C2, which prohibits threatening, intimidating, or interfering with persons in the enjoyment of a dwelling, again, post-acquisition. Because HUD's interpretation is given great weight, the question here under Chevron is whether HUD's interpretation is a permissible view of the statutory text.
Mr. Feinerman, in order to rule for you, do you think this Court would need to overrule the decision Halperin?
Not with respect to the 3617 claim and the 100.400C2 claim, because Halperin expressed doubt as to whether the regulation covered post-acquisition discrimination, but left that issue for another day. But we would argue, in any event, even if there were a constructive eviction standard, that standard was met in this case. And then we have our 1982 claim, which does not – 1982 refers to holding real estate, and that pertains to post-acquisition events as well. As a matter of policy, it's difficult to imagine that Congress, in 1968, a week after Dr. King's assassination, enacted a statute that allows minorities to move into buildings and neighborhoods, only to leave them unprotected from discrimination once they moved in, so long as things weren't so terribly bad that they had to move out. Under the defendant's interpretation of the FHA, landlords can raise the rent of Latinos, or condo associations can raise the fees imposed on Latinos so long as the increase is not large enough to force anybody to move out. The condo association or the landlord can enact a rule saying that there are no African-American guests, that Muslims can't use the pool or the parking lot, and would allow landlords or the heads of associations to sexually harass a tenant or an owner.
You mean to use landlord, tenant, and condo associations interchangeably?
I would say in this context, yes, because when you enter into a lease transaction or when you buy into a condo or you buy a house that's in a neighborhood governed by a homeowners association or a neighborhood association, the transaction doesn't stop when you sign the piece of paper or where you acquired a deed. There's an ongoing relationship with the landlord, with the condo association, with the neighborhood association. You're burdened in the property law sense with certain obligations to abide by the rules, or to pay rent, or to pay fees, and you also get privileges in the property law sense and also the FHA sense to use common areas and the like.
If you're still answering Judge Kaney's question, please finish. But then I want to ask you. The examples that you give are quite overtly discriminatory measures, whereas the hallway rule here doesn't read that way. It doesn't say, you know, only Hispanic residents can put boots in front of the door or Jewish residents are the only ones who may not have religious symbols. Could you please address why this is that kind of discriminatory measure?
Sure, and that gets to the second point, which is whether we have discrimination here. And discrimination under the FHA can be either discriminatory intent or discriminatory effect, disparate treatment or disparate impact. And I think what's behind your question is we have here a facially neutral rule. It says nobody can, well, the reinterpretation of Hallway Rule 1 in 2004 said that nobody can put anything on the doors or the doorposts, and it doesn't single out any particular group. And the question is, because this is facially neutral, can it nonetheless be discriminatory? And the answer is yes. The Supreme Court in the Lukumi-Babalu I case held that just because a law is facially neutral, it could still, that's not determinative.
What, the chicken case?
Yeah,
yeah, but it was obviously not a, you know, wasn't there a big exception for food and so on?
There was.
Yeah,
it was.
So it looked as if it was targeted on the people killing chickens for religious reasons. And
I think the court acknowledged the fact in that case that the law was facially neutral. And what the court did in that situation, and it's what this court did in the O'Hare Cemetery case, is to look
but
behind
the
rule.
I don't see what's wrong with a rule that says no stuff on your doorpost. Nothing on your door. Because you can imagine all sorts of strange religious observances that would require, you know, like ancient Rome, have statues attached to your doors for good luck and so on. Why?
It may be that
why would you give this special privilege to people who have a religious object to fasten on their door rather than someone who wants to put some non-religious decorative object on the door so that the whole hallway becomes unsightly?
I don't think that's what we're arguing. When you have a facially neutral rule, the inquiry is it discriminatory? Is it discriminatory in effect?
People are allowed to fasten other things on their door, yeah, then that would be discriminatory, but I didn't think that was this case.
Well, it depends on who. You have to look behind the rule. You have to look at the events that led up to
well,
the
I
decision
Well, I thought you were
question.
Emphasizing it didn't have to be intentional. If it were intentional, sure, that's no problem, but I thought you... When you mentioned disparate impact, I don't quite know what that is doing here, but I don't understand how that would take it out of the, you know, realm of cases like Smith versus Employment Division.
In Smith, which involved a criminal statute prohibiting
peyote. Well, that's not important. That's a criminal statute prohibiting peyote.
That's not how I was going to distinguish it, Judge Posner. In that case, the plaintiffs didn't argue that the statute discriminatorily acted in a discriminatory way towards members of the Native American church. They didn't say, Oregon, you passed
well,
this law.
What does that mean, act
it?
In a discriminatory way? Obviously, if you have a rule of general application that collides with some religious observance, it's going to have a disparate effect. That's always true.
But that doesn't mean it's not discriminatory.
Yes,
but
it does.
Isn't the question, though, here whether the reinterpretation of the hallway rule that came about after the walls were painted was undertaken with discriminatory animus on the one hand, or whether it was simply done in a neutral way. And I thought that the argument was that this is a question of fact on this record, given the way in which the rule was enforced after the walls were painted.
That's exactly our argument, and as Lukumi held...
Well, no, that's a different argument. That's an argument about intentional discrimination.
There's two kinds of discrimination.
Yes, I know. Which one are we concerned with, both or just, as Judge Wood suggested, with a deliberate discrimination? Which one? Both or one?
Both. The briefs in front of the panel press both discriminatory intent and discriminatory effect, and there's no case law or precedent
saying
that. Well,
I don't think your discriminatory effect argument.
Well, there's the standard set forth in Arlington Heights.
But I think you should respond to Judge Wood's question.
Yes,
there is a...
In terms of discriminatory intent, what the court said in the Santa Rita case, a facially neutral rule can be discriminatory if its object is to infringe upon or restrict practices because of their religious motivation. Whether the law visits gratuitous restrictions on religious conduct. And even Justice Scalia, the author of Smith in concurrence, said there can be discrimination where laws, though neutral in their terms, through their design, target the practices of a particular religion for discriminatory treatment. And what courts do
I didn't understand the plaintiffs to be arguing that this rule was adopted to target Judaism. Indeed, my understanding is that the plaintiff was the chairman of the committee that wrote the rule and indeed was in favor of it. So it's hard to see how one could say the rule was adopted to target Judaism. Would the argument then be that the enforcement campaign after the painting was adopted to target Judaism?
I would say the enforcement campaign and the reinterpretation of the rule to mean something that...
We need to focus on whether the evidence would support that, because a different way of understanding this is that the enforcement campaign was adopted with a completely empty head by people who didn't have a clue about the religious significance of mezuzah. And if that's so, then under Feeney, that's non-discriminatory. So what in the record would you highlight as saying that the enforcement campaign was adopted with a religiously discriminatory motive rather than with total indifference to the religious significance of mezuzah?
The premise of your question is that the rule was reinterpreted or enforced with an empty head, and that's just not borne out by
the
record.
Well, that's what I'm asking. What in the record shows that the enforcement campaign was adopted for a religious reason?
That Fritsch Holtz and the association knew of the importance of mezuzah.
No. Look, that's why I mentioned Feeney. Feeney holds that knowing of something does not equal intent to discriminate against it. Right? That's the Feeney standard is, was something done because of rather than in spite of? So I'm looking for the evidence that you think is the best evidence for the adopted because of possibility.
One, there was personal animus between Fritsch Holtz and the Blocks. There were tussles on the board. They had been on the board for a long time.
Well, and personal and religious are different, right?
It doesn't
but you're
matter.
Building together. I mean, I think the question is, when all of these things are taken together, could you show it was because of, as the Feeney standard requires, their religious background? And no one every single piece of evidence isn't necessarily going to lead to that. But
I understand,
you're building
personal
up.
Animus. What else?
Well, there's personal animus. Len Block tried to have Fritsch Holtz arrested for physically harming somebody and stopped Fritsch Holtz from physically harming somebody who attended a board meeting.
Sounds like more animus.
Yeah, there's more animus. There's the funeral incident, the Shiva incident, where despite knowing its significance to the Blocks, the association took down.
Yeah, that worries me because, of course, this is long after the enforcement campaign starts. Right, and the Blocks ask for an exception. They're promised an exception, and they don't get fully what they're promised. But what I was looking for, if there's anything here, is the motive behind the general enforcement campaign rather than the duration of an exception.
Whether it's accepted or not, I thought that part of your argument was that one could draw an inference from the Block's continuing effort. It wasn't just one effort for an exception. The Block's continuing effort to get their mezuzah posted by their various units, and also that you could tell from things like the funeral incident where the coat rack stays outside in the hall and the mezuzah comes down, that there is animus directed toward religion.
Exactly. That's probably the best example of an unequal application of the rule. They took down the mezuzah, which wasn't bothering anybody, but left the coat rack and the table. So you actually have a targeting of a religious item in the enforcement of this rule, which makes it more like a tenafly situation out of the Third Circuit. When the doorman returned the mezuzah to the Blocks, he was suspended for 2 days without pay. All of this... The knowledge that the enforcement of the rule, the reinterpretation of the rule in this way, would fall most heavily on the Jewish residents. The borderline implausible interpretation of the rule, which applies to mats, boots, carts, and shoes, to cover something that is not like those items, to cover mezuzahs. All those things present a mosaic of evidence that could lead a reasonable fact finder to conclude that what was going on here was not an empty-headed, strict reinterpretation of a rule, but the deliberate targeting of Jewish residents. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Feinerman. Mr. Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chief Judge, and may it please the court, I'm Steve Rosenbaum on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start with the interpretation of the statute and the regulations implementing the statute. It is our submission that the sections 3604 and 3617, by their terms, cover post-acquisition conduct that can be discriminatory, and that the phrases in particular that support that interpretation in 3604B, there are five words that are used to describe the kinds of conduct that can discriminate: terms, conditions, privileges, services, or facilities. We would submit that all five of those words can apply to both pre-acquisition and post-acquisition conduct, but perhaps the word that most clearly would signify post-acquisition and perhaps more post-acquisition than pre-acquisition is the word privileges of sale or rental. A privilege is a benefit that someone derives by virtue of their status, and there are benefits that people derive by virtue of their status as a homeowner or a tenant. As the Halperin Court recognized, that would include occupancy of the dwelling. In a condo setting, such as we have in this case, there are other privileges that are attendant to the sale, including use of the common area, use of special facilities such as a laundry room or a pool, a common use room, and the benefit of having the condo association there to pass rules and enforce rules that govern the conduct of all of your co-owners in the building.
Now, Mr. Rosenbaum, I am interested in knowing whether you think that if the HUD regulation that you discuss over in Part 2 of the brief for the United States, starting around page 32, is somehow a ground that is a more direct theory under which the blocks might recover, the regulation prohibiting interference with the 3604 rights, that's 3617, and then the regulation that forbids limiting the use of privileges, services, or facilities because of, among other things, religion or race.
Yes, Your Honor, we agree that those two...
But that's a broader theory than the intentional discrimination theory we've just been discussing.
Well, I think those provisions include the because of language, which this Court has interpreted to cover in the Fair Housing Act both intentional discrimination and discrimination that has an unjustified discriminatory effect. So I don't think it's unmoored from having to prove discrimination in this context. There are some aspects of 3617 that are different in the sense of retaliating against an employee retaliating against someone who's participating in a HUD administrative proceeding. I think that pulls away from proving intentional discrimination or discriminatory effect. On these facts, I think those regs pull us back to the because of language and the need to show that the challenged practices and actions here were because of religion.
So it's the view of the United States, it sounds to me like, that the regulation doesn't do very much. They still would have to prove that this perpetual removal of the mezuzah was because of their religion, because of the religious significance, not just because somebody had a fetish for clean doors.
What we would say is, to the extent that there is any ambiguity in the text of 3604B or 3617, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, pursuing to its rulemaking authority, has adopted rules that make it clear that post-acquisition conduct of the kind identified in 100.65B4 and 100.400C2 are covered by the statute. Mm-hmm. So I guess our first submission is that the statutory terms cannot fairly be read to apply only to pre-acquisition conduct, and the terms themselves include post-acquisition conduct. To the extent that there is any ambiguity, then we go to Chevron, and Chevron says this court has to not figure out for itself what it thinks the best interpretation is, but give deference to the rulemaking that HUD engaged in pursuant to direct command from the court. It was not only HUD, you have authority to issue rules, but HUD, we want you to issue rules within 180 days. This was in the 1988 amendments. And so there the question is this are the interpretation offered in the regs reasonable, plausible, arbitrary, are they arbitrary or capricious or contrary to the meaning of the statute? And we submit that they are reasonable and not contrary to the meaning of the statute because the terms used in the statute by themselves cover both pre- and post-acquisition conduct. And I would, on that score, I would note with regard to 3604B, the Halperin Court did not address the regulation in its decision in considering the application of 3604B to post-acquisition conduct. So I don't think there would be a direct over to reach 30, to say, for this court to say 3604B covers post-acquisition conduct would not directly require overruling Halperin on that point because Halperin did not address the reg and did not consider the Chevron deference issues, which we submit lead to the conclusion that the reg is a proper interpretation of the Act. With regard to in the evidence of intentional discrimination laid out by the appellant's counsel, it's our submission that the issue on the record established here of whether it is in spite of, whether the conduct complained of is in spite of or because of the religion of the blocks is something that goes to the jury. It's not something that can be decided on summary judgment, looking at the evidence presented by the plaintiffs and interpreting that evidence.
What is the record to Smith? Do you think if the plaintiff in Smith had said the reason why the state has refused to make an exception for peyote use by our church is because of hostility against our church, would that present a jury question?
Well, my hesitation, Your Honor, is that that's a First Amendment case, and we're talking about a Fair Housing Act case.
We're dealing with the distinction between discrimination, which is forbidden, and failure to accommodate, which is not required. Your brief concedes the statute doesn't require accommodation. So we're trying to draw that line. And the Supreme Court says in Smith, First Amendment doesn't require accommodation, but it forbids discrimination. So I'm trying to figure out whether in Smith itself, an argument that failure to make an exception, the reason they fail to make an exception is because they don't like our church,
well, the reason
would
they
be enough
adopted,
for
adopted,
a jury.
I mean, the other way to look at it is the reason they adopted the rule was...
Would you just deal with my question? Everybody agrees that the rule in Smith was adopted for reasons extrinsic to religion, and everybody agrees the hallway rule was adopted for reasons extrinsic to religion. So we're trying to figure out about enforcement and exceptions. So just address my question, please.
Would it create a jury question?
Yeah.
I believe it would.
I think the Supreme Court expressly said that it doesn't, however. I think the justices said, we assume that the reason for failure to make an exception is we don't like this religion, and that they would have made an exception if this were the Roman Catholic Church. It's even in the opinion.
But isn't, maybe the problem here is the difference between failure to make an exception, which would be one thing, and a wholesale reinterpretation of the rule, in this case almost a reenactment of a new statute, if you will, that said everybody in the state of Oregon can use wine except people in the Catholic Church who may not. And all of a sudden you would have a question there, at least, about whether there was religious animus behind such a new across-the-board rule.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. In fact, on the terms of the rule itself, do not explicitly cover mezuzahs. Do not explicitly cover doorposts. There are two rules that bear on this. One is the no objects of any sort outside of entrance door, which which can be described as an anti-clutter rule. The other is signs or nameplates must not be used on unit doors, which, again, does not apply to the mezuzah, which is on the door doorpost. There's no evidence that the application
of... Well, your strongest case would be if they allowed other objects on the doors and so on. So do the, I didn't think you mentioned that in your brief, although Mr. Feinerman mentioned it.
Well, I'm suggesting, Judge Posner, is this, that the record is a bit unclear about whether there were any other secular or religious symbols on doorposts. The record is clear that there were things on the doors themselves that were removed. The record is clear that there were things in front of the doors that were removed pursuant to these rules. The record has a gap about whether there was any other religious or secular symbol on the doorpost itself that was similarly situated.
Well, what about the clothes rack that Mr. Feinerman mentioned?
At the funeral, the table
and
the...
at the funeral, they had the blocks had a coat rack, and they had a jug of water, and they had the mezuzah on the door. While they were at the funeral, the maintenance people removed the mezuzah but left the coat rack.
Whose coat rack?
That was a coat rack that the condo association allowed the blocks to place outside their door, so that when visitors came after the funeral, they would have place to hold, put their coats.
Well, that was so making an exception in favor of religion, wasn't it?
Your Honor, what the condo association did was, on disputed facts, make an exception for secular and religious items and then enforce, pull back from that exception only as it related to the religious.
Was the only secular item the coat rack for the...
I believe there may have been a table with a jug of water for people
to wash their hands. It was just a funeral. There weren't other people allowed to have coat racks outside their doors.
The evidence on this record is that the coat rack, allowing the coat rack in the hall, was an exception granted to the blocks.
But that was the only exception to the rule.
It's the only exception to that. Well, and then there's a disputed fact about whether they also granted an exception as to the mezuzah.
But other people were not permitted to have coat racks in the hall.
The record does not reflect on that one way or the other, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rosenbaum. Mr. Hartwell.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is David Hartwell from the law firm of Pellin & Hartwell, LLC. I represent Shoreline Towers Condominium Association and Dr. Edward Frischold. If I may, I'd like to make a brief statement and address a significant fact in this case. We submit, Your Honors, that this court should affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment, since despite the artful arguments made by several plaintiff's attorneys, the record clearly demonstrates that the hallway rule at issue was enacted for a proper purpose, neutral on its face, and equally enforced as to all residents at Shoreline Towers.
What type of things did you take down that weren't mezuzahs?
Your Honor, the record demonstrates there were a number of things taken down, everything from political posters. There was a picture of a marijuana plant. There was a picture that contained a swastika in it. There was some things, some political stuff. There was some third grade art. There was a wreath. There was a bell. There was a number of different things, both secular and both religious.
What concerns me, Mr. Hartwell, is the question whether anyone's religion required a political poster to be up or a marijuana plant picture to be posted. I'm thinking of the analogy to the Lukumi case where, in fact, only one religion required this. And I don't want to focus on the time the rule was enacted. I want to focus on the time it was reinterpreted after the halls were painted.
Well, a key issue in this case, Your Honor, is that the rule was actually never reinterpreted. The only evidence in the record is Dr. Frischold's deposition at 170-3, page 31, in which the only time during the period of its ratification in September 2001 and its enforcement in 2004, the only time anything was removed was to remove the picture of the marijuana plant and the swastika.
But
there
you
was
were
no
permitting
other.
The mezuzah, according to this record, interpreted in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, the mezuzah were not taken down until the repainting. So although, in other words, religiously required things that were not actually on the floor, like boots and all the rest of these other things that were on the door post, the idea that the rule covered a door post doesn't seem to have come along. The front of the door, maybe, other things, but not the door post.
Well, Your Honor, the record shows that during that period, nothing, including mezuzahs, came down other than the marijuana leaf and the picture of the swastika. Nothing else came down. It wasn't as if other things were taken down in that interlude period. And then,
so was the rule reinterpreted to apply to the vertical dimension instead of just the floor?
The rule was not reinterpreted because, Your Honor, the door and the door frame, or the door post has been alluded to, are all designated as common elements of the association. The association is empowered to administer the association and administer the common elements. The key issue here is that both the door and the door frame, there is no distinction in the rule between those two elements. It's seen generally as the common elements. The point of the rule was to create a uniform look of the hallways, and certainly after they just spent over $1 million to refurbish the hallways.
Are there any photographs? Can you see whether anyone can even see the mezuzah when they're posted on the door frame, if you're standing by the elevators, for example?
There were some photographs taken, Your Honor, depending upon the color of the mezuzah and the size of it. It makes a difference. If there's a contrast, obviously it's more visually acute.
Aren't they uniform size or not?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, they are not, although I don't have personal application of one. We have seen several of them and looked on the Internet, and they're of all different sizes, and the cases range from somewhat of an antique relic type, traditional type case to even ones that are different than that. So there are all different kinds. There is not one standard. Mm-hmm. I understand.
So if you think that if this had been a little cross that a Christian religious sect required all people to display on the outside to demonstrate their adherence to the faith, you would have just been taking them down?
Everything would have been taken down.
On the inside of the doorpost, that's what I'm saying. If you're standing in the hall, I'm not even sure you could see it unless you went and stood in front of the door.
Anything, Your Honor, that was in the hallway, i.e. outside of the unit, would have been removed.
Even if religiously compelled, and thus no one from that religion could live in that place.
Even if it was religiously compelled,
which
however,
we have to assume the mezuzah were.
We certainly make that assumption, but one assumption that can't be made, and that certainly the record has no facts to establish, is that the board at the time either of the enactment and ratification of the rule, or otherwise the enforcement, or the individual maintenance men who were charged with enforcing it, had any idea whatsoever of the significance. It was only after enforcement that the issue was raised, and that then the board set about to determine what the issue was about by establishing the Personal Expression Committee. And the only reason that took an extremely lengthy period of time is because Ms. Block herself sought only an exception to the rule for Jewish religion, because it was her stance that only the mezuzah is something that is religiously required, and that all other religious items, be what they may, are only mere artwork. They're decoration. A wreath is
Well, why didn't the condo association have the authority to say, to make its own decision about that? I mean, if another religion requires something, whether it's Islam or whether it's Christianity, isn't it the same question?
Your Honor, it didn't seek to make or distinguish between one religion versus another. It didn't seek to make a distinction that religious items of the Jewish religion are somehow on a different level and not on par with religious items of another. That simply wasn't where they were headed. They were simply trying to make a uniform hallway, and they didn't get into that.
But there came a time, did there not, that they knew that this rule, as it was being interpreted, had a discriminatory impact on the Jewish faith?
It was alleged, certainly, by the plaintiffs, and there is evidence in the record to show that people in support of the plaintiff's position had attempted to inform the association that this created problems for Jewish residents, because this wasn't just some sort of religious artifact. This was somehow religiously akin to a legal requirement in order to be Jewish, although the record
Right, you had letters from rabbis that were sent and the like.
Right. Yeah. Well, the association, like all associations, owe a fiduciary duty to their membership. They can't, based on a knee-jerk reaction, no matter how valid the complaint is, to simply ad hoc change their rules. That's not what associations do. There was no other Jewish members of the board of directors at that time other than Lynn Block herself. Once the association was given that knowledge, the president at that meeting established the Personal Expression Committee, of which Lynn Block participated in, for the purpose of trying to understand this and figure out how to rationalize it. At the end of the day, the board wasn't going to get itself caught in the middle of trying to split hairs of what religious artifact is more important than another, and instead artfully ratify or change their rule to now allow for this personal expression of all residents within some reasonable regulation. It is a rule that is now somewhat touted as the model rule for trying to address this situation throughout. There are,
and that rule was enacted before this litigation and before the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois changed their laws.
I believe the city of Chicago ordinance had come in prior to that, Your Honor. It was certainly before this litigation and ensued, and it was not as a result of any sort of TRO entered by Judge Denlow or any other judge. It was proactively done on their own. And I think, Your Honor, that really sort of gets to the heart of the issue that certainly Mr. Feinerman and the U.S. are arguing, is whether or not you can have post-acquisition application of 3617 or otherwise reach a valid interpretation of the HUD regulation 100-400C2, because, first of all, the language is clear on its face. It just doesn't apply.
I wouldn't argue that if I were you. I mean, I think clear on its face when one side says it's clear one way and the other side said it's clear the other way usually indicates it's not so clear.
I agree with you, Ron, but what's plagued this court in both the Halperin case and the East Miller case is, okay, if we are going to extend it to apply to post-acquisition allegations of discrimination, how do we then apply it? You necessarily create a sliding scale.
Why?
Because, for example, the court has already recognized that the FHA, given even its broadest interpretation, even beyond its boundaries, is not going to be utilized to litigate neighborly disputes. So if one neighbor
that's the purpose of requiring intentional discrimination. That's not such an easy hurdle to get by.
But if somebody hurls a racial slur at their neighbor, it would be difficult to determine that that was something other than intentional or discriminatory.
Sure. No, I understand. But I thought that's why we were focusing on either neighborhood association rules, things that, as Mr. Feinerman was saying, go with the land, as opposed to, you know, the rude or boorish or biased neighbor who's just acting on his or her own.
But interestingly enough, the only times the district court has sought to extend 3617 have been when it has been neighborly disputes. In those situations, the facts were so astounding, so impressive to the court, that the court seemed to have acted almost out of equity to provide some relief to try to shoehorn it in.
Could we come back to the statute rather than what particular district judges may be doing? The 3604B says that it covers discrimination in, quote, terms, conditions, or privileges of sale. Now, I could imagine two arguments on your behalf. One is that a condo association's rules are not conditions or privileges. Are you arguing that?
We are arguing they're not conditions or privileges because when you purchase...
Why are they not conditions?
Because when you purchase, they're not conditions because they don't preclude you from consummating the sale.
That's a different line of argument. The second line of argument you might make is that although they're conditions, they're not conditions of sale, right? They're conditions
of occupancy
or ownership.
Right, they don't relate directly to sale. They don't relate to access. They relate to habitability.
Okay, so you agree that they're conditions or privileges. Your legal argument is that they are not of sale.
Right.
Now, I take it then that leaves the Chevron question is it within the agency's power to read that phrase of sale as meaning of sale and the things associated with the sale? Because when you buy a condo, you take it subject to the right of the condo association to make rules. So the rules are related to the sale. Right. The technical legal question, then, has to be, is it within the Chevron power for the agency to say this is closely enough related to the sale that it should be covered? And what's your position on that?
Position is absolutely not. While HUD was given the authority to promulgate a regulation, it was not given the authority to promulgate a regulation which essentially re-legislated the boundaries of the FHA to now...
That's kind of op-ed page rhetoric. The legal question is whether these are related enough to a sale. Is there any doubt in your mind that anybody who buys a condo takes it subject to the condo association's rules?
Purchasers do take subject to the rules. But
right.
The
so the sale itself is contingent on application of the rules. The question I'm asking is whether, given that being subject to the rules is a condition of sale, that's enough to bring it within the actual statutory language.
But it can't be considered a condition of sale.
Why not? It conditions the package of rights that you have bought. Isn't just this unit. Every condo association has certain restrictions. Maybe you need to give them, there are all manner of restrictions. You have to pay a fee. What kinds of things are theirs to maintain? What kinds of things are yours to maintain?
Had you completed your answer to the question? Had you completed your answer?
No. I haven't, Your Honor, but I...
Judge Wood and I are asking the same question.
We're
asking the same question.
The same question.
Your Honor, they take subject to the acknowledgement that there is a democratically elected board of directors that from time to time may enact, change, rescind rules and other policies directed towards the administration. The rules and the other parts, even the declaration itself, is not a static instrument.
But
they are
when
all
they
subject
have
to amendment.
Okay, but when they have those conditions, you're agreeing that, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that what you're saying is true. But if the condo association then were to pass a rule that said there will be no African-American visitors to any units here, then that would surely violate the 3604 provision. That would be a condition that you couldn't, the association isn't free to adopt that kind of rule.
Your Honor, that type of rule I don't think falls within 3604 because it actually affects the visitor. Not the owner.
Oh, it affects both people.
But the question is that whether 30, I mean, because you're taking subject to a board's administration, you're not necessarily taking subject to a particular rule. In fact, the record shows that 30 years ago, when Shoreline Towers was converted from a rental property to a condo property, Ms. Block was one of the original owners. The rule wasn't even established at that time. She was on the board and head of the committee that established it. So I think that it's not a condition of sale because it doesn't...
Well, but I think you should consider a different point since Judge Easterbrook was asking about Chevron. Now, the theory of Chevron is that Congress sometimes delegates to an administrative agency or someone to complete some statutory provision. So what have you learned about whether this conditions of sale should be thought of as a delegation to HUD or some other agency to decide whether conditions of sale should include post-sale conditions?
I think that while a CFR may be instructive as to the statute, I don't think that HUD has the authority.
What do we know about whether this conditions of sale should be regarded as a delegation by Congress to an agency to decide whether it could include, post-sale conditions?
But I don't
do we know
think,
anything about
that? I don't
that?
Think Congress ever delegated authority to HUD to go beyond their original intent. The original intent...
We're not interested in what you think. We're really interested in what the statute says. There is a statute authorizing HUD to make rules. What does it say? Does it give HUD this kind of interpretive authority or not?
It does not.
What's the language of it?
I don't have the language of that statute for HUD in front of me, Your Honor. But what the sense of it says is that the agency charged with enforcing the rule can enact regulations for more efficient enforcement of the rule. It does not allow it to enact a set of regulations to now create a whole new set of boundaries or to otherwise reinterpret the statute in a way which was not originally intended when
enacted
by Congress.
But we don't know that. I mean, I guess the question, I guess the way I would put it is, it's a common thing for agencies using their regulatory authority to elaborate on the definition of a particular word that appears in a statute, the word terms, the word conditions, the word privileges. When we say that, we mean the following things. And if HUD, in enacting this regulation, was trying to say, we think the phrase conditions of sale means things that limit the package of rights that you get, you know, agreement to associations, agreement to ongoing things, even though that might not be your preferred interpretation, if it's an interpretation, doesn't Chevron say we have to go with it?
I don't think Chevron says that. I think that when you...
What does Chevron say, do you think?
Well, I think that in terms of HUD's...
What
right
does Chevron require us to do if there are two ways to read a statute?
Well, I think if there are two ways to... I think what Chevron says, if there are two ways to read the statute, the court is to read the statute with the statutory language of the intent and to determine whether or not the CFR falls squarely within the boundaries of that intent and doesn't necessarily change it. Because the difference in issue here is that when you go to buy a condo association, you are presented with the conditions of sale, much the same way that when you go to buy a house, you know whether the house is blue or yellow or pink. It's in front of you. You have the ability to determine, is that the set of circumstances I want or is it not?
But if I buy a house and I decide to replace the roof, it's completely up to me to decide if I want a cedar shake roof or if I want a shingle roof or if I want a tile roof, whereas the roof is usually part of the common area in a condo. And it's not up to me. I have accepted at the time I bought the unit the fact that an association board is going to decide whether it's a cedar shake roof or a shingle roof or a tile roof. So there's an ongoing element to signing up with the condo association.
But there is an explicit acknowledgement by the purchaser of a condo that they are not getting what they might alternatively get by buying a fee simple purchase. They explicitly accede that to a certain extent, some of the administration of the day-to-day life of the association is going to fall into the hands of the elected board of directors.
Does that elected board of directors have to comply with various things? They can't just free will, as mentioned earlier, say African-Americans can't visit the condominium or whatever.
Correct. The Illinois Condominium Property Act requires that the board of directors act within the boundaries of that act and further impose the concept of a fiduciary duty with respect to addressing all of its members. So the problem is we're trying to shoehorn every possible discrimination case into 3604 or 3617 when it's clear that there are numerous other statutes and common law out there that a plaintiff could avail themselves in trying to instead of trying to shoehorn into the FHA. Unfortunately, those acts don't have the unilateral fee-shifting provision, which makes them somewhat less desirable.
Well, suppose the association said to a Jewish person, for example, well, you know, we sell to Jews because we have to, but after you move in, you know, you can be very uncomfortable here because, you know, we don't like you and we're going to make life unpleasant for you. But, you know, we'll certainly sell to you. We have to do that. So on your view, that's lawful.
A distinguishing factor here is that the association is never the seller.
Well, but would you please answer Judge Posner's question? Would what he just described be lawful in your view?
I don't think it would be lawful, but the issue is the
I mean, under
the
statute,
the
under this statute. No, okay, so no, sure. But the seller says, you know, I'm happy to sell to you and so on, but you have to realize the association doesn't like Jews, so they're going to make life miserable for you after you move in.
That is certainly an opinion that may be related from the seller to
the
buyer.
No, the question, but your view is that has nothing to do with, that doesn't violate the statute.
That's a personal opinion by
a seller
to a
buyer. Well, isn't that your view that
No, it's not a personal. It may be quite accurate.
No, it's not my view that that would violate. This court previously had asked a question.
Have you ever watched an Australian tag team?
Pardon me?
Have you ever watched an Australian tag team?
I have not, Judge Bowen.
Well, you're in one, so go ahead.
Well, counsel, let's make it concrete. Let's say that the view manifests itself in a resolution by the Condominium Association that Jewish residents' trash collection will be suspended.
No, I don't think that that would be
valid
insofar as it would be seeking to separate a person or group of residents on the basis of a protected classification.
So that's actionable.
I believe it is. I mean,
and that's
I think
post-acquisition. And so you agree that at least Judge Sykes' example of post-acquisition conduct is actionable under this statute.
I believe it's actionable. I don't believe it's actionable necessarily under 3604B or 3617. The question was just
well, I think you believe it's not.
It's clearly not. I understand. Can I apologize, Your Honor? But the problem is that if 3617
was meant to extend, I must say. I mean,
but if 3617 was meant to be extended,
no, but
then why would they have artfully put in the condition predicate?
No, it probably weren't thinking about it, but it does create a really goofy result. You could say, well, yeah, I'm happy to sell to Jews, but you know the association does require that Jews wear a yellow star.
Well, and again, to the extent that that creates a discriminatory, an over
intentional
discrimination. That's something completely different here. I mean, that is the association acting as the power of the administration to single out a person or group of people based on a race or religion, and then to do something to make them different than everybody else.
And so the question here is whether a rational trier of fact could find what happened here to fit the pattern you just described.
And our answer is no,
I understand that your answer is no.
But here's a key issue, though, in the case, which is really as a result of a word that was utilized by Judge Lindberg in his order for summary judgment when he stated the concept of reinterpretation. Prior to that, that really hadn't been discussed. That was picked up on very artfully by plaintiff's counsel. But the only facts in the case are during this period was not that the rule was ever reinterpreted. It was just that there were two items which clearly should have been removed from doors, were removed. But mezuzahs, third-grade pictures, wreaths, other artwork were allowed to remain. It was only on the initiation of the hallway renovation project that everything came down. There was no exception granted. And even though Judge Lindberg said, well, even if we decide that there was this reinterpretation period, although I don't think the facts were sussed out in his opinion, he took that to be an exception in favor of the Jewish residents for a period of time that was then reined in. But I don't think that that's really the proper reading of the facts. The proper reading is there was never a reinterpretation. And therefore, there was never a time when one could surmise or even a trier of fact could have reached an issue of fact of whether or not the board wholesale changed its mind to reinterpret a rule for the purpose of targeting a specific person and or a specific group of people. In addition, Your Honor had focused on the coat rack issue. The only evidence is the coat rack was an association coat rack that was dropped off for the block's use. The fact that it remained in a hallway for a period of time is because the block's unit wasn't open at that time. It wasn't as if, again, they made another exception to the rule.
Well, they dropped off the coat rack, but they pulled down the mezuzah. That's the odd thing.
And the fact that they pulled down the mezuzah, Your Honor, is evidence of the continued uniform enforcement. It is a terrible, unfortunate fact that it happened during that period to the plaintiffs. I think everybody acknowledged
that. Maybe
I
missed something.
But the fact is...
Well, I'm sorry. If you were finished...
Go ahead, Your Honor.
Was the coat rack to be moved into the apartment?
The coat rack was to be moved. There was no exception.
It was just outside to be moved in?
In addition to the coat rack, there were also additional chairs.
Does the record say that?
Would you answer Judge Bauer's question, please?
The intent was that the unit owner take that coat rack inside for its use.
With the chairs and the table.
There's nothing in the record. There's no evidence to suggest that anybody, whether the board or a maintenance man, had specifically stated to Ms. Block or the other owners.
Were there any coats hanging on it when it was there?
I don't know, Your Honor. There's no record of evidence, and I wasn't there at the time.
Well, it was for the purpose of the people coming from the funeral to hang their coats in the hallway?
No, the purpose was that the association provided a coat rack they had so that visitors at the Shiva could ultimately hang their coats. It was not for the purpose of hanging them in the hallway. The record does not state that an exception was granted to allow this to maintain in the hallway. The evidence was, as presented by the plaintiff, that it was in the hallway for a period of time. But there is nothing to suggest that the board, as an administrative body, met and said, hey, let's make an exception because, you know, we feel bad about this resident. The association from time to time provides its materials, its coat racks, chairs, tables, to residents for their use.
So the idea that you're indicating now is it wasn't meant to be in the hallway. It was meant to be put in the apartment?
It wasn't meant to be in the hallway.
Is there any record evidence of that, or is this something you're speculating right now?
I'm actually not speculating, Your Honor. It's not in the record as it
sits. So it's not in
the
record.
The record is somewhat condensed.
Well, then it's not in the record.
If it's not in the record,
it's not in the record. In fact, there's no evidence in the record either way.
Okay. Actually. I mean, I think that's an important
And the trial court certainly didn't consider
The record. The record does show that there were three items outside the Block's apartment, the mezuzah, the coat rack, and the table, and the association took one away and left two. The record affirmatively shows that, does it not?
It does, Your Honor, but The record does not establish that the board sought to make an exception or otherwise, by sort of lack of their, not immediately removing it, made an exception.
Well, why did they take the mezuzah and not the coat rack and the water jug?
Well, Your Honor, the record establishes that Carlos Reyes, the maintenance man charged with the daily pulling of the towers, removed it as he would have removed it on any day. The record also establishes that Mr. Reyes was not of knowledge of this Shiva period. He wasn't unilaterally making any exception or changing the way he did things either. And the record doesn't establish it, so it's not clear whether or not the removal of the mezuzah...
Who asked for the coat rack?
The Blocks did, Your Honor.
And that's in the record?
I don't believe it's in the record before this court.
As a matter of practical fact, the organization wouldn't move a coat rack up there just to be amusing there because they knew anything. Somebody'd have to ask for it.
It was requested by the Blocks, and they abided by the request.
That'd have to occur, wouldn't it?
Pardon me?
You'd have to ask for it before it got there.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I see my time is done.
Thank you, Mr.
Honors.
Hartwell. Anything further, Mr. Feinerman?
Couple quick points.
I've got one question, Mr. Fireman. I'm far from a scholar on these issues, but the...
He's non-Jew, but go ahead.
Although Judge Posner and I have exchanged a couple of DVDs about this case. Anyway, that said, we both watched Curb Your Enthusiasm. But the Torah says that you shall place these words of mine upon, is God speaking, upon your heart and upon your soul, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and upon your gates. I understand what a gate is, but what's the definition of a doorpost?
It's what the frame. The door frame.
So there's an exterior and an interior.
Yes, there is. And
what is it? Why can't it be interpreted that you can put a mezuzah on the interior of your door frame and satisfy any religious obligations that you might have?
There are some rabbis who would say that. There are other rabbis, including the more traditional Orthodox rabbis.
It's not clear.
Well, it's.
We've been having enough talk about clear things today.
We have the Decalogue Society, the Chicago Rabbinic Council, and a couple of experts said that if you're traditional, it has to be on the outside. And while I'm on the subject of outside, I want to talk about the coat rack and the table.
This definition of what a doorpost is can be satisfied by saying it's an exterior or an interior. And is it a matter of choice? by an individual observant Jew to put it on the exterior or the interior doorpost?
Not for traditional Orthodox Jews and perhaps conservatives as well. There's evidence in the record. The Chicago Rabbinic Council said that it was their interpretation that the mezuzah has to go on the exterior of the doorpost. It was a good faith belief by the blocks, and I think that ends the matter for purposes of this case. But I want to go back to the table.
And we shouldn't, as a court, be deciding a religious doctrine, right?
No, you shouldn't. Just like if a prisoner says his religion requires that he have a lacto-ovo vegetarian diet, if it's a sincerely held belief, that's the end of the matter. I want to talk about the coat rack and the table.
I don't understand that. We had a series of cases where prisoners said their religion demanded filet mignon at dinner every day, and I don't think they prevailed.
That didn't have to be accommodated.
No, if it's a bona fide religion, but you can get back to the table.
I would really like to talk about the table. The evidence in the record is that the table was outside the apartment and was supposed to be outside the apartment because when you come back from the funeral, you have to wash your hands before you go into the apartment. And it defeated the purpose of that to have the table and the jug of water inside the apartment. So the table was supposed to be outside. When the reinterpretation of the rule was enforced, they left the table outside, an object in the hallway, and then took down the mezuzah.
Wasn't there also some evidence that there was some sort of understanding of forbearance during the Shiva period of the repetitive removal of the mezuzah? Or at least to suggest that interpretation of the evidence?
That's a disputed issue of fact. The blocks believed that there was going to be some forbearance, and it ended up, according to the blocks, the forbearance ended up being revoked three times during the Shiva. It went up, came down, went up, came down, went up, came down, including while they were at the funeral Dr. Block.
It's ridiculous. The janitor removes the mezuzah because that's permanent. If he saw a pair of wet shoes outside of a person's door, he wouldn't remove those. A baby outside the door wouldn't remove that. So
probably he not would.
But what the record shows.
So he realized, it's a table. There's something going on. He figures there's something going on. He's got the table. Got the coat rack. So he leaves those alone. They're obviously temporary, something special. He doesn't understand, what's special. He knows it's religious. So he continues removing a permanent attachment to the doorpost. That's
Isn't
his instruction.
Isn't that just one interpretation a jury might reach?
Yes,
under which the blocks would lose?
In light of the record, there's evidence in the record that between 2001 and 2004, what was removed from the hallway were mats, shoes, boots, and carts, which not uncoincidentally were the actual things listed in the hallway.
So this is your whole case comes down to the table and the coat rack.
No, not at all.
I don't think there's anything else, actually. The personal animus, that undermines your position. Because if you hate someone and do terrible things to him because you just dislike the person, you don't care about his religion or her religion, you just don't like this person. That's not discrimination.
If that were the law, then I think most of the sex harassment cases in the courts would be dismissed because you could defend it by saying, I harass
no,
this
No,
woman.
There's a difference between motive and intent, right? So sexual harassment, it doesn't matter what the motive is. The point is you are intentionally harassing a person. That's one thing.
Not because they hate women. It's because they love
women. No, of course. It doesn't matter what the motive. That's the difference between motive and intent. It doesn't matter what the motive is. Sometimes it's hostility. Sometimes it's misplaced friendliness. But that's different from where the violation has to be because of religion, right?
Right. And it could be
not because you dislike a particular person regardless of his or her religion.
May I answer the question, Chief Justice Easterbrook? I mean, let's assume that a white landlord or a homeowners association burns a cross on the lawn of a black resident, and when hauled in the court, says, I love black people. Some of my best friends are black people. I have nothing against black people. I hated that particular black person. And what I did, I wanted to do something to get under his skin, and I knew what would get under his skin was to burn a cross on his lawn. Under your interpretation, there was no discriminatory animus towards African Americans in general, but I still think that would be found to be a violation.
No, I agree.
Found to be discrimination. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Feinerman. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will take a brief recess before calling our next case.